Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. So in this next episode about the body, we want to talk about the senses. So as we begin our walk down the Wolverhampton canals, as we usually do, the birds are going mad. The ducks are homing in, thinking we've got a bit of bread for them. So the senses then. Body and senses, very important part.
Yep, certainly we have sense organs, don't we, as human beings? Which are body parts.
Aye.
Eyeballs, ears, skin, nose, so on. Taste, what is it? So you've got sight, hearing, touch, smell and taste, the basic ones. But what are the senses? What are we talking about? How do they work? Because we know they do things, but how does that work? In other words, what is perception? So you suddenly realise you want to think about the senses in the context of a general consideration of the human body. And before you know where you are, you're in deep water, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, what is perception?
Yeah.
Answers on a postcard,
yeah.
Please. This is all kind of
tricky.
It's tricky stuff, and
yeah.
But I feel at this point inclined to ask something that's prior to that, and to ask how are we to think about this? What's the best way of thinking about this? What's the best way of considering this? And so we try and get to something a bit more fundamental in our way of thinking. Now, all of these questions, the question of perception, the question of the nature of the senses, and so on, get answered by particular disciplines, experimental psychology, neurology, anatomy and physiology, and so on. You know, there are specific disciplines which address our questions. But I'm not wanting to just kind of rehearse the little bit I know about the way those disciplines proceed. So I'd say I wanted to kind of actually even reconsider how we should proceed. Just taking that one step back, that extra spadeful, you know. Now the disciplines like experimental psychology, anatomy and physiology and so on, they all proceed from a certain paradigm, and each one has got its own underlying presuppositions which go unquestioned and are probably not even consciously known by many practitioners of these disciplines of inquiry. But that's the area we need to get into with our question, which is a properly philosophical question, I think, which is to say, actually, no, hang on, let's step back a bit and just we need to examine the way we think about this and try and evaluate the various options, or perhaps create some way of getting a purchase on this big question. So the first thing I want to ask about the best way to think about the senses is, do we regard the matter in terms of structure? Do we try and look for underlying structures? Do we try and identify structures? As of course is what you do with anatomy and physiology. You actually identify material structures when you investigate the senses. Or do we try and conduct our investigation in terms of process rather than structure?
So what do you mean by structure?
A structure is kind of is semi-fixed or semi-permanent.
Right.
You know, it's like an unchanging scaffolding. This is about the scaffolding and the framework we use when we think about a certain problem. And our problem in this case is, if you like, the nature of the senses and the associated topics.
Like perception.
Yeah. I mean, that's our fundamental question, the nature of the senses. We're wanting to elucidate that.
But sorry, just to pause here, but there's a really amazing swan just passing us on the canal. Wow.
Hello, amazing swan.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's a teenage swan. You can tell because there's still bits of brown. Anyway, sorry to digress there.
Handsome fella.
A beautiful creature.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, carry on.
This process versus structure thing here isn't an argument about the nature of thought. It's a decision that we're making at the outset of our inquiry.
As to what
apparatus we're going to use to conduct that thinking.
Yeah.
You know, we need a metaphor to structure our thought, or a paradigm to structure our thought about this thing. And I'm saying that hitherto, and in the special disciplines that I mentioned, the thinking about the senses has been as presumed at the outset, but there is an underlying structure to the senses and related matters, and you know the term structure there connotes something at least semi-fixed, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm proposing that we think instead in a process manner, that we're not looking for structures, we're not looking for anything fixed really. We're looking to identify and describe the processes, and to see it as a process from the outset, as
right.
You know, and that seeing as a process at the outset is our toolkit, our philosophical toolkit.
Yeah.
So that's what all that kind of hesitant stuff was.
Yeah.
There around.
So it's an important distinction structure. About different ways of thinking.
Yeah. Well, different tools that you can bring to bear, different. I suppose what I'm saying is we don't really form detailed understandings of anything without an apparatus to help us make our inquiry into that something. You bring some concepts to bear at the outset, otherwise you can't start. It's kind of fairly straightforward, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you...
Although those who may not be familiar with the idea of process thinking might find it not that straightforward, perhaps.
No, because language, this type of language that we're using, is fairly kind of structure-based, it's syntax-based, and syntax is kind of rules that form structures, definite structures. So, structure thinking comes kind of natural, and process thinking requires a bit of a poet's skill with language, you know, which of course is a very rare thing in this world.
Yeah.
So, what I'd be wanting to say, I mean, is, well, we should think about it from a process angle. And you say, well, why? You know, why? And I say, well, because we're not wanting to get overly metaphysical. We're not wanting to speculate on the really true nature of the universe and the really true nature of the human being and human consciousness. We don't want it to be doing that. We don't just be speculating and then trying to make that stick. What we want to be doing is starting with the life world, you know, with this, just this. It's walking down the canal, or it's just being alive, sitting in an armchair, or whatever it might be. So starting with the life world, and I think in the life world, you find if you examine it with sufficient commitment to being observant and truthful, you might say, you will find that the life world is one of process, that everything is movement. And what appear to be like structures are just kind of they're actually processes.
Yeah.
It's just that their rate of mutation might not be noticeable to you.
Yeah.
In passing, certainly, unless you kind of make measurements and stuff. But the, you know, the, all the mountains in the world are flowing down, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I think that we can just take that from our life world. Everything changes, and
yeah.
I think, well, let's see how the senses look from that vantage, you know. So we can our model, our analytic model that we proceed with. It's clear, and that we can kind of commit ourselves to it. Well, I certainly commit myself to at least having a go, despite the problems and difficulties around language. Have a go at trying to take a clear look at the senses and understand what's going on purely from a process angle, from a process point of view. Just dropping the whole idea that we need to be seeking structures, you know, or that there are structures there anyway. You know, so that's what I'd want to do with it. I mean, at that point, I think you can look at the life world to see what you've got there that's useful. I mean, taking a big shortcut here, but I think we can identify in the life world three kind of lumps of process that I would say are readily identifiable by anybody, as I say, just taking a look. And that means, you know, taking a look with some kind of clarity or quietness of mind. In other words, taking a look and bracketing out what you think you know already, for instance, you know. Just putting that on one side so that there is a particular kind of apprehension takes place. So, I mean, how does that work? Well, I think we can identify in the life world psyche, you know, the mind, if you want to do, you know, that way in which you know yourself in your solitude.
Mm-hmm.
We call that psyche, you know. That's just, you know, we've got a nice ancient term because this has been recognised in the life world for a long time. Psyche. The other thing which it doesn't take very much to recognise is culture. I mean, it's just such a big part of your life world. You and I speaking English.
Yeah.
And
walking along this canal in Britain.
It was built as a matter of cultural decisions, you know.
Yeah.
This is, you know, the culture. The world that human beings have made for themselves.
Yeah.
With their ingenuity and thinking skills and prediction skills.
The very device we're recording this on now.
For instance, yeah. So not only the artifacts, of course, but the thinking patterns, the methodologies of inquiry, the ideas of morality, the ideas of the good, the ideas of the true, etc. All this stuff that's carried in a culture, the notions of God or whatever that falls into that part of the concept spectrum. So I'm going to think everybody in the life world is able to distinguish psyche and is able to distinguish culture. The other one I want to kind of pick up here is nature. Again, we have an idea about that.
In the last talk we were talking about sex, and we were talking about culture and nature.
Yeah, so we're here again, but we've added something else. We've added psyche. But what I'm wanting to say here is that these three, psyche, nature, culture, which we could give other names if we wanted to, you know, we could coin terms if we wanted to. But these three are actually processes. Each one of them is a process, not a thing. Now, we might be tempted by language, and philosophy into thinking that the psyche is a thing, nature is a thing, culture is a thing. But given the commitment that we made to trying to have a stab at doing some process thinking here, let's just say culture, nature and psyche are not things but processes. And again, I think we could kind of sit still for a moment, close our eyes and recognise that.
Yeah.
Straight away.
Yeah.
Straight away. We can go into the art gallery and see that culture is a process.
Yeah. Even cultures that lasted for a very long time.
Yeah.
And seem to be, you know, some things have lasted for thousands of years and remain the same. But as we know from history, they do eventually change and often just turn to dust and a whole new thing emerges.
Yeah. I mean, that's... Well, the study of history just helps us with all of these claims. There's nothing that you would be able to contradict through a study of history, even though today we're kind of remaining this, having this kind of like little poke around what we call the life world, you know?
Yeah.
It's a slightly different technique. So, yeah, these things are processes. Culture, you know, our cultural world changes. We like to look at old photographs or go and look at archaeological ruins and so forth. The evidence is everywhere. Psyche changes. Well, if anybody's going to tell me their psyche isn't in a state of movement.
Oh yeah. Like you're still the same from the moment you were born.
Yeah. I'd raise one of my eyebrows then. Oh yeah, that. Even though I've got
only one eyebrow.
Yeah, only one. Yeah. I've actually never heard anybody claim that.
Nah. Well, it's impossible, isn't it? They couldn't possibly claim that.
Yeah. Well, processes is. We're on a good bet. We've placed a good bet, putting our money on wanting to think this out through process. And not through structure or things, you know, architectures. And same with nature. What do we think? I mean, nature is the very paradigm of change, of cycles, of randomness sometimes, so forth, seasons. Rotations of the planets and the moon and so forth. Flow of water, breeding, death and birth. Growth and decay, all that, you know. Again, we're in process city. So the three things you've got to consider from the point of view of process. And I think what we do there is we describe, you know. And there's about a whole library of books if anybody's got the time. 70,000 PhD theses.
Yeah,
but your basic operation there is description, I think. When it comes to actually expressing something about what's gone on when you're conducting these kind of investigations. So the other thing I'd want to say here, and in keeping and to be consistent with everything else we've said so far, not only are these three things processes, but they are nested together into one bigger process. You know, and that bigger process is human life. And it can be considered under collective and individual headings, and should be, to my mind. You know, I think you get a philosophical question, you want to look at it from the point of view of the human individual, but also from the point of view of the human collectivity, the society, the tribe, whatever it might be, the class. So how do they interact, you know? How do these three three processes already quite complex. You know, processes always ends up being complex, doesn't it? But yeah. Certainly when you've got a few in parallel, you know, they build the complexity.
They're all there, working together and sometimes working against each other, possibly.
Yeah. So how can nature, culture and psyche interact? Well, they interact through... Well, firstly through being nested together, as I said, you know. It's like nature contains culture, doesn't it? Nature's the bigger set.
Yeah.
You know, nature can embrace culture. Culture can embrace nature, but only as a concept, not actually as the totality of existence. See, nature's a word for that in some ways. So nature embeds culture, but culture embeds psyche. Psyche is, you know, it's born into culture straight away, you know. It lives in culture and it dies in culture with a few little glimpses, perhaps, that seem as though they're outside of culture. Usually like extreme experiences, you know. Yeah, the kind of psychedelic experiences, explosive meditative experiences, sexual ecstasy, birth and death, you know, it's like big stuff. Otherwise, you know, psyche is embedded in culture. It's also actually, you know, because it's embedded in culture and culture is embedded in nature, it's also embedded in nature. Well, it's embedded in nature, sure enough, you know, we've got like neurons, eye lens, retina, rods and cones at the back of the eye, nervous system. The whole thing completely dependent on the rest of the body for nutrition and maintenance and electric exchange and raw materials.
And the brain for interpretation.
And the brain doing whatever it does. On what? Well, interpretation, as you said, but on data, on information. So the thing, not only are these three processes embedded in each other or nested in each other, but they are also in interaction in the greater system through the exchange of information. That is what goes backwards and forwards. You know?
Yeah.
And so you've got this information exchange that's taking place between three nested systems. Through certain organisations of matter are employed in that as well. I suppose that's the nature bit, you know. In other words, an eye made out of carbon-based proteins, and, you know, which acts as some kind of a transistor or transformer or something, but which is implicated in an information exchange between nature, culture, and psyche.
Yeah.
Which themselves are processes. They're swirling. So you've got these swirls coming together. And they're kind of intersecting at the eye, really. Even though I'm veering dangerously to the old-fashioned way of trying to understand perception philosophically, was to see human perception and human sense organs as like gateways between an interior and an exterior.
Yeah.
And the sense organs' job was simply to take in corpuscles of light or light waves, in other words, information, in through the eye. There's some kind of processing happening after it entered the inside, what would be the subjective area, the inside.
Yeah.
And is then processed some way. I mean, Kant, it's made sense of through the admixture of the categories, you know, and space and time, that we actually put the space and time ingredient in this raw data that's coming in. And then it gets kind of delivered somewhere onto some kind of a screen, rather like the back plate of a camera.
Yeah.
So that you've got this sensitive screen which registers the image, and that is what it is to perceive, because in human beings that screen is somehow conscious. And this is a metaphor, actually, and it's a metaphor I'm trying to escape with all the talk about process, because it does rely on a structure which says the human being is rather like a camera obscura, you know, and where the senses are acting as the kind of pinhole, they're acting as a nexus between an outside and an inside. and the information passes from outside to inside.
Yeah.
And it's registered on this kind of mysterious screen.
Yeah.
But it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. Philosophers dreamed it. I mean, Aristotle worked with this metaphor. Kant worked with it. The empiricists worked with it. The positivists have all worked with this metaphor without even sometimes knowing they're working with it.
Yeah.
And all this in the effort to have a conceptual framework or a metaphor with which to organise their thoughts around the problem of knowledge.
Yeah.
Because they know knowledge is something to do with the senses. We know something if we've seen it. You know, in Sanskrit, vidya is one of the many words for knowledge. They've got a very great taxonomy of types of knowledge, but vidya is a great one, you know. Knowledge, basic knowledge.
Yeah.
It comes from the same root as video, because to see is to know. Yeah. Seeing is believing, you know. So it's all down to this kind of camera obscura metaphor, sometimes called the ocular metaphor. It's certainly something that Nietzsche wanted to get away from and put great effort into deconstructing, because he saw that it was taking our thought along certain tramlines, which it's true, they lead to philosophical conundrums that are insoluble. What is the nature of this mysterious photographic plate at the back of the head, if you like?
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah.
You know. Just for instance, and what exactly happens when perceptual data is made sense of? Depends who you ask, you know. Say, Kant, it's got this kind of fixed thing. Nietzsche says, of course, interpretation happens, but for him, it's there are far more possibilities in the way the interpretation will go than for Kant. For Kant, it's all kind of mechanical. It's space and time and categories, causality. All get added to this data that's coming in before it's presented to the screen. For the empiricist, there's nothing much happens except there might be some interpretation in the light of experience, of prior experience, but nothing pre-existing. For Kant, space and time are a priori, they pre-exist. For Nietzsche, culture, we do have some kind of definite interpretations that take place according to the structure of our sense organs. For instance, we can't see infrared or ultraviolet, we only see a narrow spectrum. You know, so there's that kind of limitation from the senses, and that is imposed by the human organism itself, and that's imposed by the state of affairs.
Yeah.
It's just imposed. But there's this other layer of interpretation which comes from culture, you know. You know, an adolescent in a strongly patriarchal culture sees a woman's ankle and has a certain response, you know. It's like the interpretation of the significance of the woman's ankle has gone on in the light of the culture that child has been brought up in, and that,
yeah.
And such culture for nature is one of the interpreting machines. But either way, you know, we've all got this same pattern. But nature say was wanting to get rid of it. Was wanting to get to find ways of thinking outside of it, because it produced too many philosophical conundrums. You know, the nature of the mediation between inside and outside, the cogency of inside and outside as notions, the mysterious nature of the photographic plate, you know, resulting in all the epistemological squabbles of the last few hundred years. You know, empiricism versus, you know, rationalism, etc., you know.
For me, I feel the information come in, obviously. Yeah. I hear things, see things, I feel things. And I don't just feel things through my sense of touch, but when somebody walks into a room and they're angry,
You know.
Or they're sad,
yeah.
Or they're full of joy,
yeah.
Or whatever, you know, you feel...
Yeah. Yeah.
You feel that coming off him, and I'm not going to go into how exactly all of that happens, but I think it's probably acute sensitivity to body language, probably.
Yeah.
So, I feel all of this coming in, and it changes me.
Yeah.
I feel that it changes what's going on inside me. So, then... The information that I then give out to the world is then different. It is then changed.
Yeah.
So
to feedback
somebody
loop.
Walks into a room 5 minutes ago and they're angry. And then they leave and you walk into the room. The conversation I would then have with you would be a little bit different.
Yeah.
To the one I would have had with you if they hadn't walked into the room, or if they'd walked into the room in a completely different mood and said very different sentences, happy, sad.
You said what you're describing is...
So there's this connection between the inside and the outside, and I see in a way in myself, I almost don't experience them as separate.
Right.
It comes in, it changes me, and it comes out, and what comes out is changed. And there's this there's this exchange all the time.
Yeah. Plus you change what comes in. It's like the information exchange isn't just like passing a piece of paper with a number 2 written on it around. It's like at each little pause in the movement of one of these lumps of information. It gets changed, it gets processed according to some process or another.
Yeah.
But what you just described, I think it's a really good bit of phenomenology there. Except you see, you could quite easily abandon the notion it something coming in from the outside.
Yeah.
You don't need that notion, do you?
No,
you
not kind really.
Of, I think you've appreciated.
Just for the purposes of being able to describe it, that was the words that I was using.
What I wanted to find is what vocabulary have we got that'll let us abandon inside and outside.
Yeah.
Because what is going on, it adds nothing to your description. What you described was beautiful phenomenology, you know, it's all beautiful meditative recollection of a meditative encounter, you know, of what it feels like and what it is like. And you described a complex process made up of nested and overlapping and intertwined other processes.
Which is that happening is constantly to everyone, no matter whether they're aware of it or not.
Yeah.
It is happening.
Yeah. And the senses have a role in that.
Yeah,
that's,
absolutely.
You know, that they
because
were,
the information comes in via the senses.
Yeah.
And
except it doesn't come in.
Well, yes. Well, I don't know. I mean...
No. I mean, where's the inside, where's the outside?
Yeah.
You know, this is the thing. When you get the process.
I mean, if you're going to use the word information, though, the word itself implies...
It's a bit loaded.
The information is coming from somewhere, though, doesn't
it? It's not like the information is coming from somewhere. What is happening is that there is a dance of information exchanging and process and changing.
But even the word exchange, though...
Yeah. I know it seems like exchange between... places, but it is, but it's not exchange. It's not an exchange of information between structures. It's an exchange of information between processes.
Yeah. It's almost like, so if I see it like this, it's a bit like, imagine a roller coaster.
Yeah.
It's like a little bit of info. There's two roller coasters, or say 10 roller coasters next to each other. A little piece of information jumps off one roller coaster into the passenger seat of another one next to it.
And then turns into an aardvark.
And then immediately starts moving and changing. And then that little piece of information then can jump maybe into the next one and immediately start moving and changing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that kind of scenario. Yeah. When the couches of the roller coaster are themselves processes.
Yeah. So the movement of information is happening between processes rather than between fixed points.
Yeah, and they are information processes as well.
Yeah.
Now, I might be getting carried away here with a sort of a metaphor deriving from you know, the current technology, which, of course, is what happens. Everybody tries to think about this stuff in any particular age, generally dredges up a technological metaphor. You know, Descartes and the clockwork, you know, clockwork universe. So.
Yeah.
Because clocks were the most sophisticated technology of the day, you know, really finely engineered clocks. So, but we've got these computer things and the internet, you know, this reticular network structure, and you start thinking, oh, everything's information, you know. And it's a thought that can quickly become a metaphysical speculation. Definitely.
Yeah.
And it was an idle thought I had this morning, again. I do kind of keep toying with this, but even though I know it's science fiction, you know, and all the rest of it, possibly. But what was great about it was that when we brought it down to Earth, it became process, you know, it became the recognition in the life world of incessant movement.
Yeah.
As something that's undeniable. Just that. Just that's where that led me to, you know. But of course, you think the senses, you think information. I actually looked on Wikipedia, but put in senses, you know.
Yeah.
And the first thing it said was, you know, organic, physiological structures in creatures, blah, blah, blah. Which allow the transfer of data, I think it said. And it's there, you know, and there's no way you could think about the senses without dropping on the notions of information and data. But it's corpuscles of light, which carry information to tell you that there's a duck over there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there really is a duck over there.
Yeah. 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 So all that. So, yeah, I think I'm going to try and summarise that in about three short sentences.
Oh, wow. Well, good luck.
the best way to think about the senses and the processes that they're involved in is starting with the presupposition that's dynamic process is the nature of things. Or at least saying to yourself, this is the nature of things as I find them in my life world. But we then, following along with this, find that we can deal with some categories to help us to get a purchase on what we're trying to describe and understand. And those categories were psyche, or the mind, if you want to, you know.
Not that we'd have this distinction between the mind and the body, remember?
No.
After all the stuff we've put in the other podcasts.
Exactly. And I expect you to incorporate all that in that one little...
assuming that you've listened to all the other podcasts we've ever done.
We've got psyche, we've got nature, and we've got culture. And we give a brief description. We see these not as things, as we might be tempted to do, but as processes. And not only as processes, but processes which are in interaction, nested together in interaction inside a bigger process, which is called life, human life or life, you know. So that's where we kind of got to. And we discussed how conventional thinking on the senses is generally conducted under the shadow of a metaphor of a structural metaphor of which says that the human being is something like a camera obscura, and that we wanted to replace that, for reasons we'd already given, with a description of the way the big processes that we identified actually interact. Now, the thing we missed out of all that is consciousness. I mean, all of this could happen. These interacting nested processes could be going on without any consciousness. That could happen purely algorithmically or purely mechanically. But of course, when we know that we know. And somehow or another, that state of affairs is built into our system made up of interacting subsystems.
Uh-huh.
So, that little fact means that we can actually in a sense perceive our perception, or know our perception, or be with our perception. But that does require a certain mode of consciousness. Yeah. And obviously we know we're conscious, we know that we know. We actually know that we have loads of modes of consciousness, don't we?
Give us some examples of modes of consciousness. Just people are confused by that.
Dreaming, being agitated, being emotional, being cool, reasoning, thinking, creating, being quiet, meditating, etc. I'm saying to get to grips with what I'm talking about here, which is actually directly in the life world, apprehending the senses at work. Apprehending the senses at work, which I think would be pretty good. That is actually possible if one employs a certain mode of consciousness. And that mode of consciousness is a rather perhaps uncomplicated meditative style, you know, because what it is, it's an openness and a receptivity without too much extraneous noise, and without too much of the extraneous noise of presupposition. It's possibly alert at some level to the fact that things are moving, things are changing, things are dancing, as this very investigation occurs. Nevertheless, we can glean something. And that I would say is the method, you know. That's the method of using this style and this style of reasoning and these metaphors that we've decided to employ for coming to some kind of an understanding of the senses and the action of the senses and how they work. And it seems to me that what you find in that situation that it feels like, this is what it feels like, the universe is seeing itself.
Yeah.
Because the clamour of me and my beliefs and my past experience has somehow been bracketed or has just popped out the back door for 5 minutes, you know?
Well, it might become a bit of background noise for a while.
Right, but yeah, so that there's this... I very often use the word clarity, you know, and it's probably not exactly the right word, but it's got a bit of a sense of what I'm trying to get at with this shit. But it does, it feels, because, and I think it's directly correlated to the lack of noise.
Yeah.
It feels as though...
It's truly amazing lack of noise or a lot less noise in yourself can do. And the experience of it. Sounds really boring. it's nothing there, that just sounds like nothing. But having a quiet, spacious mind, it's actually the stuff you can dive into once you get past the noise is astonishing.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying that if we are with ourselves as we use our senses, as we perceive, in the manner I've described, you might say, like an amazing aesthetic, maybe erotic experience, you know?
Say that again, in a minute.
Well, I just basically there trying to say, employing that kind of very light touch method that I mentioned earlier on, you know, just simply having a quiet receptivity. If that is brought to bear on, in other words, if one is with oneself when perceiving something, when looking at the water, when looking at the swan, when looking at the cloud, when listening to the music, when feeling the love of skin, that use of the senses, which is aesthetic and pleasurable and erotic, but it's in that moment that one gets this sense that the universe is seeing itself. It's almost if like one little bit of the way the universe is set up was a little tiny bit different, this situation wouldn't be happening now.
Yeah.
And everything that's produced in this moment as a confluence of myriad forces and chains of events back to the beginning of fucking time. This is only happening because of all that.
Yeah.
And in that sense, the universe is seeing itself. You know, and it just kind of felt like that. And it's not like seeing is like a mirror picking up an image or something passing through a fissure, which is like the eye or the ear, coming through a gate. All of that stuff disappears, and you realise after that it is metaphoric to think like that, think of the senses as gates. No, all there is this process.
Yeah.
This process of consciousness, you know, which the universe knows it is seeing itself.
Yeah.
But you can see how the metaphor, you know, one of these box-like metaphors, this camera obscura metaphor, if you're really captured by it, that none of this stuff will happen.
Yeah. I like your term, sea of process.
Yeah,
I like the idea of it being a sea, currents in the sea, but obviously there is, there's no divisions between the bodies of water, because there are no bodies of water.
Waves.
Yeah.
Waves, currents, ripples, yeah. Turbulences, whirlpools.
Yeah.
Placid bits.
And I think sometimes people struggle because new information comes in and they feel that they shouldn't be changed by this. They should be strong. Upsetting information. Yeah.
But even having resisted something, one is changed.
Yeah. See, they're changed whether they like it or not, but they're trying to pretend to themselves and others that they're not changed.
Yeah. Well, there's a little process within all these enmeshed processes, a little sub-process that does this little game of saying, I don't like this, it's got to stop.
Yeah.
That's what that is, isn't it? So.
And certainly what I was talking about before, if we're using this phrase, the sea of process, imagine that if we, like the outside and the inside, so the outside is the sea, and the inside is also the sea.
That's right, yeah.
But perhaps the only thing between us is just a slight current that would alter. Or
well, there are many
weather pattern.
There are many lines in the swirl of existence.
Yeah.
In the swirls of existence, there are many lines. You know, lines seem to be able to be significant to themselves in some kind of way, which is me being able to know that I know something or I don't know something.
Yeah.
Me being able to see that I am seeing something.
Yeah.
You know, and that self-reflective process, that looping back there. Is what enables one to do a meditative, yogic, phenomenological investigation of the action of the senses, very just directly in the life world. In other words, in the world of felt lived experience that we actually live.
Yeah.
So there is this opportunity, is what I'm saying, to catch a glimpse of this anthropic principle, whatever that is. This is, but what I'm talking about here isn't a bit of fancy, you know, and a bit of something that you've kind of reasoned out, like some kids on ecstasy at a party in a kitchen very late at night, you know. When they're on about the seventh bong or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's a very real, palpable, shattering, astronomically intense experience.
And the word shattering there is exactly right, because
I don't know why I said that, it sounded nice, but of course it is, isn't it?
Yeah,
and shattering of structures.
Because I was just, you know, because often we talk about suffering and trying to, if possible, alleviate a little bit of suffering in the world.
Yeah.
And I feel that perhaps, well, I know for sure actually that a lot of people suffer when they start to, when they begin doing yoga, often they can come to the point where they are starting to dissolve.
Ooh.
And their boundaries are starting to dissolve.
Oh, no.
And there's this frightening moment where everything you believed that was you seems to be just now this puff of smoke drifting away. And there's this grasping, and when in that grasping is there's suffering, there's pain, there's tension. But
you did go to art school, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, but if you can think of yourself as the sea, as currents in the sea, and everything moving within that body of water and flowing, and thinking of yourself as a process of flow, if you can relax into that, then I'm just saying it becomes a lot less frightening.
Yeah.
True. And it becomes okay.
Yeah, true. We don't want to be scared, do we? If we can help
it.
I mean, what you just said, yeah, it captures a lot of it. The only thing I'd say about it is you're not describing you talking yourself into some little fantasy that will make things easier, you know. And it's not like
if I wanted to make things easier, I'd have a different fantasy, believe me.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Or it's not, whatever, it's not. It's not anything that you have to create imaginatively.
No.
It's actually what you will find in your life world.
Yes.
You don't have to, you know. And I'm just in case you think Anna was telling you to tell yourselves a story and then live with that. I mean, people do that kind of stuff.
You could actually turn that into a story and just work through the story rather than actually feeling it and experiencing it for yourself.
Yeah.
But
that ain't what this is about, is it?
No, that's not what I was trying to say.
I'm saying you can just observe all that stuff in your life world.
Yeah.
But you have to, and there's not much technique to that observing.
No.
You know,
I mean, it's not absolutely obvious. The process of change is absolutely obvious, and there's no escaping it.
It's not witness conscious particularly, you know, which is a kind of a moral operation. It's not like that. There isn't really a split, because it's only the process knowing that it knows. That's all it is, which it does automatically.
Yeah.
At least several times a day in a human organism.
Yeah. That's it. That's humans for you.
Yeah. So I don't think we've done anything except describe what anybody can find.
Yeah.
It's easy to observe this. And it sounds
but it's not so easy not to be frightened of it, which is why I was really mentioning it.
Well said. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's this thing that very, very often when somebody's having a freaky experience, you know, with their yoga journey or whatever you want to call it, if you say to them, oh yeah, that's fine, it's just part of the process, I've had a similar experience, you're not alone, then that very thing can be just enough. And it was for me, especially on the night I thought I was actually dying. When my meditation was that strong, I actually really thought that was it, and I was terrified out of my mind. And Peter said, oh yeah, it's okay. Yeah, don't worry about it, it's just part of the process. And it did help a lot. So
it sounds as though it wouldn't help. Was I really so cruel as to say that?
Well, because I remember I jumped
I'm very,
out.
I'm very sorry.
I jumped out of that meditation, screamed my lungs out, and I said something to you. I'm dying. I'm dying. And you said, no, you're fine. You're fine. You're just having a deep meditation. It's fine. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, it helped me not to be frightened of it after that, because it's like, this is part of the process. And everybody who stumbled out of the yoga room into the kitchen when I'd been cooking for a yoga weekend in tears or whatever, or terror or whatever, Pete puts them through.
Don't be silly. Very nice man.
Yes, you're a very nice man. But, you know, this is going to happen. Everybody's going to encounter the terror, I'm sorry, but it's going to happen at some point. You know, it's all part of it. But if somebody's there saying it's okay, it's part of the process, I've been through it too, it's just always helpful. Yeah. And if you can be less scared of it, it'll just, you know, unwind itself and unfold itself so much easier. We've gone way off track there, really, but
yeah,
that's just something
it's
I
want to... It's a bit of a ramble today.
Yeah. Who just wants to throw in there? You never know. Yeah. Somebody could be listening to this right now who had the exact same experience as me last night.
They might have done, yeah.
And it's fine. It's okay. Deep meditation can be like that. But you do come back.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Don't scare them, and you don't scare them. It's fine. It's all fine. And there's actually great stuff in there. Once you've got over being frightened of it, it's really amazing. So, in conclusion...
In conclusion? What does it say on the piece of paper?
See, we wrote all of this down really clearly and comprehensively before we came out.
Consciousness.
And then we got a little bit distracted.
Self-consciousness in a sea of process. That was the heading, right? We know that we see. This is marked in moments of aesthetic stroke sexual pleasure. This is a particular mode of perceiving. It is remarked upon in the tantras.
Mm.
It's just, as I would say, yeah, one of those opportunities, because every moment is an opportunity, technically. In the reality of people stumbling through life, through the human life, some moments are much better opportunities for enlightenment or some kind of shit like that, yeah, than others. And the senses, because they can kind of deliver aesthetic stroke sexual pleasure, jouissance, energy, which of its very essence challenges anything fossilised in our being, anything rigidly struck over... overstructural in our being. It's a very great opportunity, a very great pointer for us. The senses, the pleasures of the senses, being alive,
being awake,
and being awake and letting all that information flow. Information flow.
Oh well, I hope some of that was useful for somebody. I'm sure it will be. It's you know, packed with goodies in there. It's a bit loud at the moment. We've just been passing under railway bridges and there's lorries going by now and everything. So I think we've come to the end of our walk, so we'll sign off and we will see you again soon.